Welcome to Context, a podcast that explores different places through different lenses with an architectural focus. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the very last strange episode of Context with a K. Typically, I host this podcast, Kensani de Klerk, from Cambridge in the United Kingdom. But today, the tables have switched. Maxwell Mutanda, who will introduce himself in a moment, will be in conversation with me. He will be spearheading this episode. Begin by introducing yourself, and then we can get right into it.
Hi, thanks, Kensani. I am Maxwell Mutanda, calling in from pretty hot, it's summer now, in Harare, Zimbabwe. And I'm really delighted to be in conversation with Kensani, who I first met in Cape Town. And it's really quite a pleasure to be able to have her talk about a city that we both know. I won't say know and love, but a city we both know intimately. I'm very interested, firstly, Kensani, to get your take on carrying out this research from the perspective of being in the UK, right? How does it feel to be your being, you know, your body in a space that doesn't accommodate you, when the research really speaks to spaces that don't accommodate a whole gender, right? So, I mean, you've been tackling for, say 50% of a nation in South Africa, and now you're just a drop on an island. How has that driven the work and also challenged it, I think, will be interesting. So looking at Cape Town from afar is something I'm very excited about. And, of course, the historic links of where you are with the city of Cape Town.
I think it's a really strong question to begin with, and I'm glad. Of course, I think that's something that is always on my shoulders, at the back of my sort of ethical standpoint when doing the work. Being at the University of Cambridge, being the only African, being the only Black person in the whole graduate department is something noticeable. I don't know if it's noticeable to others, but it's very noticeable to me. Again, I will caveat by mentioning something that I don't think is unfamiliar to other South Africans who have left the country in pursuit of work that is concerned with the country. And that is the baggage that comes with coming from a hyper-racist and very complex context, and sometimes having to let go of the knots that has sometimes in some instances held me back from having an open mind to considering different methods that might be appropriate to what we would consider a very unique sort of situation happening in South Africa. Right now, of course, across the South African nation, there is the coronavirus has just conflated issues of economic crisis. The health system is being heavily tested. It wasn't in good condition to begin with before that. There are, of course, there are also good achievements that have happened, but I'm trying to emphasize that with the coronavirus, there's a new normal has set in, and part of that new normal, a femicide has been declared, and a really harsh gender-based violence across the country that has seen hundreds of women and children being raped, murdered, assaulted. And of course, gender-based violence transcends just physicality. It's also something that affects mental health and well-being. Mm. So just to contextualize the sort of that is something that I keep myself informed with. So being outside of South Africa, I try not to lose sight of the everyday situation. Being part of the subject that the research is concerned with is also something that I'm very cognizant of. And also I have to sometimes separate myself from, because of the nuanced experiences that women of color face in South Africa. Already that term in itself can be considered quite contested when looking at the experiences of women of color in South Africa. The categorization of people according to race has been divisive. Women of color attempts to acknowledge the very different aspects between people of color, but at the same time tries to foster a conversation between women of color in Cape Town, so that the, some sort of qualitative aspect can come out of this research.
I'm in awe of your organizational ability and coalition building, right? And just as a point of reference, you know, I had taught at the University of Cape Town, so I'm very much aware of what it means for a Black woman to even study architecture at that institution, right? Or to be a Black woman in that space suddenly became very apparent to me because, as people may know, apartheid in its meaning means separateness, and it was a spatial practice, right, that divided people. And so I think one of the things that still, for me, is apparent and so important in the work that you do is these spaces are created by a certain type of person, right? Let's just say normally very, very heteronormative, normally very male, and normally very white, right? Mm-hmm. And so now thinking of you transported to the United Kingdom, where only 5.2% of students accepted onto architecture courses are Black, and then in a country where the total number of registered architects is like less than 1%, it's not lost on me, right, how suddenly your work is compounded, right? And I think I'm always very mindful and always very proud of the work that you do. You're one of the first people I know who was very explicit, if you want to maybe just touch on matriarchy, that really spoke to this importance of intersectionality, which, as you mentioned just now, the whole world is starting to understand that these issues of race, these issues of gender, these issues of the climate disaster really are magnified and can be seen across different geographies and demographics as multipliers, right? Whereas people never used to think that way. And you're really one of the first people who was speaking to this. So just, I mean, for those who don't know, you want to just give us a quick history of matriarchy, maybe?
Yes, of course. Thank you for this question and all of those words. I think it's always good to be surrounded by inspiring people. I'm constantly inspired by you. Maxwell and I are in a collective called Unguta, which we will get onto later. But just a side note, matriarchy. Wow, what a journey. So a lifelong journey, might I mention, and many lives to come after me is really not about me at all. I'm mainly just the catalyst in this whole thing. I kind of mark my critical thinking anchored at the sort of pinpoint that's roads falling in South Africa. 2015, when there was a big eruption set off by the student movements across the country that began to address the need for decolonial education, the need for the institution to address symbols of oppression in the curriculum, not just physically. That statue was just a representation of a historical system that persists. And then, of course, the aspect of free education. And I think, of course, matriarchy began as a blog that responded to that sort of political context at the time. I thought there is nothing in my current curriculum that is speaking to me from my positionality. I feel ashamed that I do not know anything to do with architectural history, architectural design that is African, that is sub-Saharan African, that is South African. I don't think I can represent myself outside of this degree if I continue. I was an undergrad at the time, and it was my final undergraduate year. And I remember that we had a brief about Woodstock, you know, designing a clinic in Woodstock.
Sure.
And then designing an opera house. And I rejected the brief. I rejected the brief. I was so angry. I remember somehow using my anger to write an article every week. I wrote a blog article and I read and I tried to translate that. And the authors that I referenced, I tried to find. The internet was really working in my favor because I could find some of those contacts. And I will make mention, and I know it will probably sound quite highlighted, but there was a really lucky moment in 2015 where I had been enrolled in a course, History and Theory of Architecture, that was led by now a colleague and friend, but of course at the time, a teacher, Tomar Belanda. He was quite new and kind of exposed our whole cohort to existing projects, existing histories that were just not put on the reading list, that were unfortunately as well also in the archives, in the annex of our libraries, but very unnoticed. And if you were not suggested that as a fresh young mind in the architectural industry, you could very well leave university with modernism as a contemporary sort of outlook and approach to architecture.
And a specific view of modernism, right? As like the savior, like modernism will heal the world. Quick shout out to Thomas Berlander here, because yes. I think it's important to mention, right, that he creates the space, he empowers people, right? So I can remember him letting you do things or putting you in position where your voice could be heard, because I mean, it's a real thing. And I will say this, you know, you make it seem as if everything just landed on you. Like, I really like the definition of luck as preparedness meeting opportunity. And mm-hmm. let's just acknowledge you're prepared for the moment, right? Mm-hmm. You met the moment. Like, you weren't the early person. Don't knock the work that you did, because it was pretty fantastic. So what I also am interested in is this idea that you mentioned then of how the archive is there, right? But it's almost abandoned, neglected, or hidden, right? And you sort of need to bring that out. I thought that was a really lovely, lovely point. But let's move on to what you're doing now, specifically with Cape Town. I don't know, you can correct me if I'm wrong. If I was to put the work into one sentence, it would be, when do you feel safe? Right? Mm-hmm. Just quite simply asking that one question, and it starts to speak about, when do you feel safe at home? When do you feel safe when you're traveling? When do you feel safe having fun, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So tell me how you got to that point, and how is it manifesting for you?
I think that I kind of see myself as a very volatile atom in this work, in that reflecting on matriarchy as well, I'm quite responsive, but at the same time, understanding that response should somehow manifest into a stepping stone that can contribute to the sort of institution or the place that I've left a mark in. Mm. And so that's the sort of approach that I'm taking to the work right now. And the work, of course, investigates the relationship between public infrastructure and what is titled at the moment, urban violence experienced by women of color. That is a working title that is constantly unpacked. And safety becomes one of the very focal points for trying to understand, as you mentioned, when things happen, but what constitutes of that moment. And of course, a moment, as I would sort of refer to it throughout the work, culminates in the form of a narrative. And those narratives are constantly in flux. And architecture is perceived traditionally to be static and permanent. So what a paradox, what a dilemma I find myself in constantly. And architectures also seem to be a product. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, this is all changing quite fast now, all amongst contemporary architects and professionals and researchers. So a huge part of the work is considering the process as a conduit and a vessel, that conduit that can host something that is fluid, that context is inherently fluid, the way in which the issue is occurring socially in South Africa is not particular, or some would argue not linked to the architectural discipline, but is hosted in a vessel, which is by all means a physical and designed host of this socio-spatial issue. And so I see the process of the work and the design, the research method, as a conduit and a vessel in that sense. Yeah, I think that the idea of safety therefore becomes generated and grows and develops through a constant collection of narratives. So I've set up at this point in time a platform called Public Agenda. The work interacts with participants. There's a huge emphasis on an ethical procedure, because I think architectural ethics are not, let's say, at the top of the priority list when doing field work. It's quite extractive.
It is.
I find very difficult to reconcile with as an African, and as an African in the UK, that comes with a lot of, I would agree, skepticism. And so I put at the top of my priority the ethical aspect of this work, and to also challenge myself to have an open ear to how the work can gain a patience, even though it's constantly fluctuating. In order to be meaningful, one has to keep up with the pace of the people involved in the work, or else what's the point? It becomes a capitalistic machine. And so this platform is collecting the narratives of participants in South Africa, self-identifying women, survivors of gender-based violence, and asking a series of questions, topics that eventually start to feed into these fictional narratives and tropes, which can imagine what a safe sort of environment, a safe sort of social provision of infrastructure could look like. There's a policy side to that. That's a side that I'm interested in. After having studied city planning, I quite like that dry, banal legislation.
I'm down with you. I think that there's exciting, but there's something that you mentioned there, which I really enjoyed, where you talked about patience. And it reminds me of Adrian Marie Brown's quote of like moving at the speed of trust from emergent strategy, shaping change, changing world, which I think is very clear in the work. This idea of ethics is, I mean, as someone who's also interested in public engagement with research, to sort of say, how do you conduct this research when the social structures that you are addressing have historically caused harm, you know, for people? So like coming from institution, how do you do academic research when the institution is one of the things that has caused harm, right? And so I really appreciate the way in which you've really met people where they are and also met people at the pace in which they want to engage. And I'll say this, for those who don't know, in Kansani's research, she's made provisions for counseling and legal advice for people who need it, which I think is amazing. But the thing that really comes out for me, which I don't know, you may correct me if I'm wrong, is a sense of optimism and a sense of joy in the work. Mm-hmm. So in the way that you speak to this urban violence, but you're also not replicating images of gender-based violence or violence on people of color in the way mm-hmm. you represent it. Do you know what I mean? In choosing to show like the places where people are safe and the way you isolate them. So it's like just the outline of an entranceway or a stoop, right? And by negating everything else, for me, really only sort of foregrounds the positivity or speaks to the negative through a light, revealing the darkness through light, which I think is amazing. And I don't know if that was a purposeful strategy of yours, right? To sort of say, how am I going to talk about this really quite heavy subject matter in a way that brings people to the conversation?
It's a very confrontational question. And I think it's one of the very first questions I had to ask myself with my supervisor, who is Dr. Nick Simchik Aris, an architect, an ethnographer, and an inspiration. Yes, it's tricky. I think that the always putting a visual language to something, I think it can have very scary implications. And I was very careful to, again, ethically, remind myself that the people that I'm engaging with are recipients of gender-based violence and are living in that context, which I cannot imagine living in myself. Being familiar with the sort of geography of the Cape Town inner city, CBD, the outskirts, this is something that I know a bit about enough to know how bad it could get, but I'm not in that position myself.
Let's just let people know here that how the urban can perpetuate this is at every point. Say you're taking public transport. That act in itself leaves you vulnerable to gender-based violence, where you could get assaulted in a minibus. Say, you know, you're living in an informal settlement and you have no electricity in the place that you live, so you need to charge your phone. Mm-hmm. And to be able to charge your phone, you're now at the mercy of, say, a man who has a solar generator or he's plugged into electricity and then, again, puts you in a vulnerable position, right?
Yeah.
And then, so I think, yeah, I mean, it's very hard for people to see just how pervasive this problem is. So, I mean, yeah, I can imagine how difficult it was for you. Let's talk about toilets, right? How does someone manage to sustain a dignified life, right? When they don't have access to indoor plumbing, you have these shared toilets, And let's be honest, ablutions mean something else for women than they do for men, right?
Yeah.
So again, there's a point of exposure. And so there's so many points in which you can't just show something. It's so interesting for me because, you know, Tokyo has this huge campaign of trying to make public toilets seem approachable. But the public toilet means something completely different to yeah. where we're coming from. You know, you can't just get a Toyo Ito designed toilet and suddenly things are great. So I mean, there's a lot, and it's I mean, just the street, you know, just walking down the street itself, you know, is then again a point. So you're saying it was something that you really had to question, and your supervisor, so what was the advice, you know, how did you reconcile this?
I think clarity is key throughout the research process. Again, also testing and learning. I did not have this foolproof plan. I really had to detail as I was going along. And I think that also speaks to the sort of visual representation, color coding, and also discussing with respondents how they feel about that image. You know, there was also a speed to it because I was in conversation with 8 participants, 10 at some point, and then 8. And I'm in service of them. So they're expecting something from me, and I have to maintain a standard. And that does require a sort of system, if you like. And I could only learn that system, I think, after topic 3, where I started becoming more aware of the way in which I represent safety, the way in which I represent a sense of fear, the perception of violence versus violence, and sort of how that could find itself capturing a snapshot of the information they've told me, not encapsulating everything they've told me. So behind these vignettes, if you like, are layers and layers and layers of stories that haven't been visualized. And that will come out through the research as I go on. You kind of the layering of, dare I say, but I do appreciate the work of Bernard Tschumi, the Manhattan transcripts are very iterative, going through it, looking at it from different angles, understanding how to respond physically to something that is purely movement, something that is, you know, from the event, and it has a speed to it. And that's the sort of projection I have for continuing to establish a system that comes from that visual representation and remaining in contact with participants, because that's the thing, right? Extraction, it's complete when you've decided to leave your participants behind. And so they're in it until the end as well.
So let me just highlight for people, topic 3 was where surviving gender-based violence. That was after you looked at life in lockdown and my life before lockdown. And I think what's so interesting about that in the visual representation of topic 3, it sort of counters the narrative of safe streets, right? This idea where if a street has many eyes on it, suddenly, wow, you know, you're safe, right? But then this really sort of says, well, look, the street actually exposes me in a way, right? Because of all the eyes on it. For me, I think one of the things that was interesting was topic 5, which became my favorite place because, you know, I mean, Cape Town, let's be honest, it's a very segregated city. Mm. And so for that for me was definitely like the spark of optimism and joy. And how does one find this in a city that's so divided? And then topic 5, specifically in the one image that shows the city as being walled in, if that makes any sense.
That was number 11, was it?
Yeah, that really spoke to me a lot, to sort of say, okay, I'm starting to see it. And then obviously afterwards, which was the one for me, became topic 6, my front door, right?
Yes.
Which now it's like this really different from the other representation. It really focused in. It really sort of changed scale to almost be like at a 1-to-1, if that makes any sense, right? The others were really urban and spoke of the body and movement within the city quite well. But then that one really took you to a sort of a private and intimate space that, I mean, I just truly, truly, truly loved. So for you, the turning point was 3, right? The narrative representation, I think, is quite interesting. You know, architecture isn't static. I think it's something you mentioned before. Or architecture isn't like complete as just this physical edifice, but it becomes more, right? It's I don't want to say machine, because then really I start to feel like I'm perpetuating modernist ideology. But it's like it's this vehicle for life in a way, right? which I think starts to come through in the way you talk about it, in that, yes, it is the built environment, but more than that, it is the story of a life lived, which I really enjoyed. So how do you see the narrative structure developing then? And do you see the links between each topic? So let me put it this way. I can't quite segregate the participants. Like, I can't go from one topic to the other and create this clear narrative structure of one participant versus the other. So I'm curious to see how the narrative will, and, you know, thinking about Shumi, like the jumps that you make, right? So you've got quite a lot of jumps, right? Yeah. So do you see yourself doing more jumps or like then remixing it in a way? I'm curious to know.
This is perfect timing. I mean, I think the very dry word that comes up and has recently come up in the department, kind of briefing students to consider implementation strategies. What do you consider implementation to be in the context of your research? Mm. Some people take this quite literally because their projects allow them to. It's not a bad thing. In my case, implementation, again, goes back to this conduit. And it's really about getting from what I would refer to a site, the context, these stories, these narratives, thematically kind of categorized at the moment, through the conduit to C, design. So B is the sort of conduit, bear with me. But what does this constitute? Like, what does this mean? And for me, it's really the sort of unpacking of these vignettes to begin to think of what sorts of existing infrastructures in Cape Town Central Business District exist that in the now, post-pandemic, or let's say in the pandemic, in the new normal, because before when this research started, this research method was never something I thought I would have imagined. I thought I would be in Cape Town. And to my favor, this, I think, is a bit more appropriate to ethically doing this sort of field work. So what sorts of existing social infrastructures lend themselves to opening up to not just places of sustaining the sort of activist energy that is the one last bit of collective hope that is happening in South Africa amongst not just survivors of gender-based violence, supporters of anti-gender-based violence, but also the greater public interest. But at the same time, what sorts of social infrastructures exist that can sustain that sort of therapeutic activism, as Carl Kassegaard, who is a professor at Gothenburg University, would refer to as alternative space. These sorts of spaces that allow us to heal, but also allow us to prevent. At the core of this problem is, you know, a different typology. It's not a safe space typology for survivors of gender-based violence. It's a safe space typology that also considers preventing the social issue from manifesting.
So it's for the everyday. It's like, yeah.
It's exactly, as Yasmina Bibi John would refer to this, really, these rights to everyday life. And as you will know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but being born in Africa, living, having experienced life in Africa, and then leaving and coming back, you kind of establish a set of standards that you know you cannot go without. The fact that I can cycle in the middle of the night in Switzerland, I can cycle, not always in the middle of the night in the UK, is something that I don't want to let go of, but I wouldn't have known otherwise had I not experienced just a snippet or a taste of that. And so I think that these vignettes, the joy, the sort of jubilee that comes from them is also generated from a very explicit imaginary that tries to show, be in service as an architectural designer and someone who can manifest an image, manifest something that is quite tangible from words and stories, to equip people with a sense of dignity that they very, very much so deserve. And so that's the sort of the outlook that I have right now when it comes to thinking about how I can find mutual strings that place themselves geographically in these social infrastructures. It's all there.
I know where you're coming from with this idea of, you touched upon this early, about looking to public policy in the future, right?
Yeah.
And I'm reminded of, you know, the work that you did with GCRO, Gauteng City Region Observatory. They're very interested in data, and I like data as well.
Yeah.
But it's more in how does the data tell a story, right? Numbers in and of themselves mean nothing unless you can really push a narrative that can push change, right? And so I can see that, right? Because obviously it's very hard to visually just represent numbers, but the work that you do also cuts across qualitative methods, right? And so this, I think, brings us back to Hunguta with the Southern Ecosystems Project, where it's like, okay, how do we talk to or up to or about spaces on the continent through this idea of just the quality of life, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and I think that was important. It was a huge turning point for me to sort of say, you know, this way of looking and of understanding it means so much more than just, you know, what it looks like in the pages of a magazine. And I get that from the work to sort of say, okay, how are you going to create this sustainable idea of safety, which is both preventative and also just something quotidian? And yeah, it comes at a policy level because that policy has been absent, you know? It just it does exist, right? The spaces don't exist because there's nothing written about it, you know? And in that absence, a lot has been allowed to happen. I think about, it's not a binary, but, you know, looking at apartheid, it was always the haves and the have-nots. And the spaces for people developed in the gaps, right?
Right.
It's not like someone legislated it. They're just like, you know, whatever, right?
Yeah.
And then that's what happens. So it's this lack of policy that I think people aren't as aware of, and I think is quite strong in your work as well. So you're at this point, and you said the department is also speaking of this point, and do you see yourself pivoting quite substantially in the next year? And you sort of intimated to me that you have a site which is outside of Cape Town that you're interested in.
To answer the last question first. I think that looking outside of South Africa becomes a very interesting point of departure when thinking about public policy. What models exist, I'm not here to recreate any wheels. And again, looking outside of South Africa, I'm fascinated because I'm working on my counter intuition, and it's something that presents many challenges and presents many things that I wouldn't have stumbled upon had I not put myself in that position. So I'm going to be looking at the Frauenhäuser in Switzerland, which is essentially an organization that has been dealing with the social provision of shelter and services that come with helping gender-based violence survivors, children and women, leave their situations of abuse and hopefully create independent lives for themselves. Created in the 70s or so. So fairly dated.
Something interesting there, right? In thinking of the parallels with the apartheid state, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at one point the apartheid state is putting in these structures, right, to perpetuate the violence. And at the same time, in another location, structures are being put into place to challenge it. As dated as they were, you're dealing with, you know, the relics of the apartheid system now. So I think it's important. You can't understand apart. Because I do see your work as being very planetary, right?
Yeah.
It speaks to a universal ideology. So for me, I'm interested in this move because it will be a way of understanding the part, being Cape Town specifically, by looking at something outside of it. So good luck with that. And
thank
to you.
Yeah, I will say that the context is always shifting, and being responsive to that is something that I will, with my full chest, also say it's quite an African ideal. Of course, Maxwell, I'm sure you are very well aware of the sorts of informal economies that work in response to a constantly fluctuating and sometimes drastically fluctuating context.
Sure.
And the fact that we're interested in this kind of work and bringing it to the forefront, optimizing it, is, I think, something that one can look to the future with an optimism. But it is definitely a long-term project.
Definitely.
Therefore,
I mean, I'm always interested, like, in the moves that you've made, you know, like this specific move in particular, right, with the MPhil and what that meant. It was really an acknowledgement of the fact that the work speaks to a length of time beyond even the degree, right?
Yeah.
Because that's one of the things that's apparent to me in the way that what you're doing and where you're doing it is structured, to sort of say, how do you almost create the teaser, the amuse-bouche of a body of work, right? Sure, you'll get a degree after it, but in a way, it's also an acknowledgement that this work can go further, which I think is commendable on their part and on your part as well, to sort of say, we can see this going forward. I mean, I'm reminded of your trip to Paris, if I'm not mistaken. So do you want to quickly touch on that before we go?
I'm very happy that I went. It was for an OECD high-level conference on ending gender-based violence. I really do emphasize that ending word, because I am very fascinated and interested with public policy, sort of global organization, philanthropic rhetoric, and where it meets local states' rhetoric and where it meets rhetoric from the ground. So I sort of primed myself with trying to understand these different stakeholder conversations in order to also find a way of identifying where they in fact intersect, and if at all they do. There was some South African representation there.
From government?
From government, yes.
So what was your takeaway? Because I agree with you, this idea of ending gender-based violence makes it seem like it's smallpox, right? Like, here's the pill, everybody, and it's over.
And here's the action, you know? Here's the plan, here's the action, the minutes are there, now do it, it's going to end. And of course, this is a pluridisciplinary, we throw this word around all the time, it is indeed a pluridisciplinary initiative. Sure. And people were very surprised that I was there. You know, yeah. I'm very used to going into a space, being the odd one out, and saying with my full chest what it is that I'm here to do, because that's what it's going to be, right? And it is, in fact, through that conference that I found out about who funds local NGOs from outside of South Africa that are concerned with gender-based violence. And then the web sort of revealed itself to me, and I thought, oh, this is how it's working. This is how organizations are benefiting. This is the model. And I think that's something I need to be very aware of so I can insert myself in it.
Find a way
of really actioning these sorts of initiatives. It is difficult and very unsettling at times, I will say, but it's also learning.
No, please continue with it. Like, I mean, I'm of two minds, because I understand where they're coming from, because, you know, how do you at like a UN, a United Nations level say, oh, we're just going to investigate gender-based violence. No one's giving you money for that. Right. I mean, but in honesty, that's what they're doing. But they're also coming at it with this hope, right, to say, okay, let's be declarative. And I'm that kind of person. When I do my own work, or say, particularly within grant writing, I try and really be declarative and say, this is what it will be. Even if I'm knowledgeable of the fact that, you know, you may never really reach it, but you also have to put a stamp on what you want, even if it's an impossible dream. I am very proud of the work that you're doing, and I think it's an example for everybody. And keep at it.
Hey, thank you. I very, very much so think that we'll be having these conversations until old age. I really respect the work that you do, and I think that I will repeat that it is very inspirational to be surrounded by constant provocations within the realm of course, your endeavoring in sustainable development, and that is. Yeah.
I mean, look, I'm with you, right? And I used to say this when I was teaching, you know, Tamara is also very good at saying, you know, people need to know that architecture can't save the world, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't try, you know? So, yeah, it's a weird one, but I will say it's sustaining. It is traumatizing, I'll be honest with you, right? Having to confront trauma, You can't be numb to that, right? I don't see how anyone can be. If you are, then I worry for you, right? Yeah. So I do understand what it means for you to do this work, and I'm also grateful to know that you find moments to find joy, right, and peace in your own life. So keep that up.
Well, I will add one more point. Please visit Maxwell's website. It's maxwellmutanda.com and immerse yourself in the body of incredible research. I will leave it at that. You need to go check it out.
Good. Thanks, Katani.
Thanks very much for having me, Maxwell. If you're interested in getting in contact with regards to conversations on context, please don't hesitate to email me, Kinsani. The email is on the website. And also to please comment on all of these episodes. Your critique and feedback is what keeps the conversation going. And of course, this is the end of season one. See you next season. Ciao.
Congratulations.